Well, my name's Owen. I am an alcoholic.
Hey,
I'm so grateful to be here. Before I forget, Mary, happy birthday. What a great thing. Yeah?
I forgot. I've got a card that I'm sending around.
Good.
Sorry.
And thank you, Karen. Thank you for asking me today. You know, gratitude is such a big part of my spiritual program and my sobriety, and it's something I learned in these rooms. So I do want my talk today to be about gratitude. I am grateful for all of you being here today. I'm grateful for waking up sober today. I'm grateful for this miraculous program, and I'm grateful to God. Grateful to God who's always there for me. So I'll start where I was born. I was born in Torrance, California. Raise your hand. Does anyone know where Torrance, California is? All right. Yeah, Torrance is a suburb of LA out near the ocean. Beautiful place. The ocean breeze comes every day, the beach culture. It's got really expensive and really crowded, but my parents and some of my siblings are out there, so I still go visit. I was the sixth out of eight kids in a big Catholic family there. And my mom and dad had met at Cornell University, and my dad got his PhD in engineering. And the space race was on, so they were trying to draw all these engineers out to California. And so he signed up with Northrop, and so I grew up out there and had a loving family. And I used to blame all my problems on my family, but the 12 steps has helped me see that it's not them, it's me, you know, and that's the good news. I grew up and, you know, I had two sisters before me, and I love these sisters, Diane and Nancy, and they were just total overachievers. Like my sister Nancy, she graduated high school as valedictorian when she was 15. She got into med school when she was 18, so at that time she was one of the youngest doctors, but it was interesting because even at that time, I resented her and I was in her shadow since I was younger than her, but she had a humility. She just, anything she tried, she did well. Like she went out for the track team and she broke the record for the mile. You know, she was one of those people. But, you know, looking back on it, as I talk about, she says, you know, she really had to work hard for all that stuff. You know, and so coming up behind them, I had teachers who would say, you're going to be just like your sisters, right? And I remember that made me feel so insecure. I felt like I had to be perfect just to be accepted by my family and by my parents. And one time, you know, this is a little incident, but it's funny how this blew up, you know, and it was something I thought was so big that made me drink. But I remember coming home and being so proud that I got an A on a math test because my dad's an engineer, PhD in engineering. So I show my dad the paper. And I think it was like a 90, like a 96 or a 97. I said, Dad, I got an A on this. And he looks at me and he goes, why didn't you get 100? And I remember it crushed me. It just crushed me. It was like, and what that said to me with my insecurity was that I had to be perfect, right? I had to be perfect. And that's the thing. As I grew up, I get little glimpses. I would get 100 once in a while, but, you know, I couldn't be perfect. In high school, there's 500 kids in my high school class, and I graduated. I was the sixth out of 500, so I'm number six out of 500 kids, but I wasn't valedictorian, so I still felt like a failure. You know, I got into UCLA on an academic scholarship, and pretty quickly there, I would drink myself. By the end of the first year, I wasn't getting straight A's, so I just drank myself into dropping out, you know? And at that point, I thought my life was over. I was 19 years old. I thought everyone thought I was a failure. I had tried college. And the only relief I could get was through alcohol, When I drank, it didn't matter anymore. When I drank, everything looked okay. I didn't feel less than other people. You know, I was okay when I drank. And I started drinking on a camping trip with my brother. It was really nice. We were up in Ojai in California, and we were sitting by a river. And he and his friend had got a six-pack, and it was the first time I drank a beer. And by the end of that first beer, I remember, I want another one. I wonder if I can have one of theirs, you know, that kind of feeling. And so all through high school, I would try to drink every chance I got. And a good friend of mine who's sober now, but who was my big drinking buddy, who was my partner in crime, his house was near the high school. And this was back in the day. They used to let you, if you had a parent sign thing, they'd let you go off campus for lunch. That's like unheard of. I tell the kids that these days and they think it's crazy, but we would take advantage of that. And we'd go to his house and we would drink beer. We'd do tequila shots and then go back to school. We thought that was smart. And I remember friends, you know, covering up for us, saying, man, you reek of alcohol. You really better, you know, go find some place to go hide out. And I remember one night, Heineken, my favorite beer, was on sale. And I had a fake ID. I was only 18. But I went and I got a case of Heineken. And I was just driving around. My parents had given me an old VW van. So I'm driving around drinking, and I black out. And, you know, this is one of the things that I am so grateful for, that, you know, that I didn't kill myself, that I didn't kill some person. But I wake up, and my mom, you know, the words you never want to hear when you wake up, my mom said, what happened to the car? I'm going, I don't know. She said, the two right tires are flat. I said, really? She said, yeah, the neighbor, he said he heard you coming down the road last night. And he said he heard it thunking and, you know, going down the street. And so what happened? And so she drags me outside, and I look, and the right two tires are flat. I have no idea how the right two tires are flat. My dad's sitting there with just a scowl on his face. He says, you better help me, you know, help me change these tires. And I remember looking at him and looking at my mom, and I checked if I had my wallet in my pocket, and I just turned and I walked down to the liquor store. And that's the way I lived my life then. I would not deal with problems. I'd walk away from anything that I'd done, take no responsibility. So my life became really chaotic. It became really destructive. I started to get really depressed. You know, I thought my parents would disown me, you know, when I flunked out of UCLA. So I went and I stayed with some friends. I still had some money. I drank for 2 months. I started losing weight. You know, I'm pretty tall. I'm 6'4". And I got down to like 140 pounds. I was really skinny. I was throwing up. I wasn't eating. And I thought the end was near. I really thought that I had to drink myself to death, you know. And it's so sad. And my parents reached out to me, and they said, why don't you come back home? Why don't you come back home? And they said, if you sit down, we got to talk about this. You can't drink the way you're drinking and live here. So I went back, and I look at that as one of the things, you know, they love me unconditionally, and they showed that then. And so we had to sit down, and my older brother, who I really respect and love, was there. And I sat down with them, and they said, look, we know what's going on, and you can't drink that way. We want you to try to get back in college. We want, you know, we support you. We're here for you. So you can come back here, and you can drink moderately. And immediately I thought, yeah, yeah. And so in my mind, I was going to try to stop drinking. But when they said that, my alcoholic mind thought, oh, yeah, this is cool. I'm going to do the deal. And I'd done it. I know all those things where I've been drinking all day. And how? Oh, this is my second beer when it's really my 12th, you know. So pretty soon, you know, I'm drinking and sometimes keeping it under control, sometimes not. I get back into college there. And I'm actually doing okay. You know, I talk to a counselor there and tell her a little bit about my story, and I say, I just can't understand why I'm so self-destructive at times. She goes, why don't you major in psychology? Psychology is the study of, you know, human behavior and the reason, the way people think. And so I majored in psychology. And then as I looked at the courses, they had a biology minor. And they had this whole system where you were looking at how the neurochemistry of your brain affected the way that you behaved. And I thought, this is exactly what I need. I need to understand this. And it was a really great course. And I did learn some things about psychology, about, you know, the history of that. Just at that time, a whole area of psychology was coming out, positive psychology, that I was really interested in. Because psychology in general had been studying dysfunction, you know, depression, you know, schizophrenia, all those things. And they need to address that. But there were some new researchers who were looking at things like, you know, happiness. What makes people more happy? They were even looking at this thing, gratitude. It was just the beginning of that. So there was some hope there. And I got into college, and I was doing okay. And all of a sudden, the college opens up a pub on campus. They're not going to serve hard alcohol, but they serve beer and wine. And the pub opens every day at 10 a.m. My first class was at 10 a.m. So most days, where do you think I ended up? In the pub. And like-minded college students there. But, you know, I went back to barely making it, but I was, you know, I was doing okay. And, you know, it was one of those times where slowly the disease progressed, and then quickly it progressed. I had a friend, and, you know, those incidents happen, I think, in all of our stories where, you know, we're given a moment of clarity. And one day I was at the pub and a good friend of mine, someone who was really important to me, was really sick. And they had told me the night before, can you drive me to the doctor tomorrow if I'm not feeling better tomorrow? And I said, sure. So I go to the pub and I call them up and they said, I'm really not feeling good. I think you need to get me to the doctor right away. And my sister's a doctor at this time, so it would have been easy. I could have just picked them up and taken them to the doctor. But I said, okay, let me go say goodbye to my friends there at the pub. So I end up having another pitcher and not getting there and having another pitcher and just forgetting about it. So I go home and I pass out and my mom wakes me up the next morning and tells me that this friend is in the emergency room and they're operating on them. Turns out they were bleeding internally. They didn't know this. They were bleeding internally, and when I didn't pick them up, luckily they called their mom, who took them to my sister, and she saw what was going on and got them into the ER and got them into the operating room and saved their life. But in that instant, I couldn't say that lie anymore, that drinking wasn't hurting anybody but me. I saw that it almost killed someone who was really important in my life because I wasn't there for them, because drinking was more important to me. And so I get on my motorcycle, I drive up to the hospital, and I see this person as they're being wheeled out of the emergency room, and the look on their face, and it was that moment of clarity. And I thought, okay, this is enough. I'm not going to drink anymore because I know this. But here's the, you know, the pernicious part of alcoholism, is I was drinking 2 days later. Even though I had that moment of clarity, I almost killed somebody, I didn't know about AA, I wasn't willing to reach out for help, and I started drinking again. And you can imagine, you know, just how that felt. And I just kept drinking myself deeper and deeper into this hole, that black hole, where I didn't think anyone drank the way I did. I had drinking buddies, but no one drank the way I did. You know, I would drink up, I would wake up, and I would drink just enough beer so I wouldn't have to, you know, throw up. And it was really a dark place to be. At this time in my life, I also met the most beautiful woman in the world, my wife, Patricia. We've been married 29 years, and she's amazing. She is amazing. And that brought some hope into my life. That really did. But she would look at me, and she would say, I can't watch you kill yourself. I can't watch you drink like this. Because I was able to, for a very brief time, put on that facade and not drink around here or control my drinking. But, you know, as an alcoholic, I couldn't do that very long. And she would see the ugly side come out. She would see that, and she would see where it would put me. I'd go on three-day benders where I would just drink beer, not eat at all, and I'd get to that place, you know. And and I'm really glad she did it. She gave me the ultimatum. She said, you know, you got to quit drinking or I'm not going to be with you anymore. I can't watch you do this. So at this time, we were still in California, and she had relatives in Tyler, Texas. I'll ask you, does anyone know where Tyler, Texas is? Okay, Tyler, Texas, it's about halfway between Dallas and Shreveport. It's in a dry county there, Smith County. So she says, look, we got to get you out of L.A. We got to get you out of here. Let's move. And it, looking back, she was pulling a geographic, I realize. But she gets me there, and there's no alcohol there. And so for a couple months without AA, just white-knuckling it, I'm not drinking, and I'm miserable. I'm miserable, but I'm not drinking. So I talk her into letting me go back to LA. And I have my buddy Mike from high school pick me up at the airport, and I get drunk again. And when I come home, we're talking there, and she said, look, I can't watch you do this. So I make the ultimate challenge to myself. I look at her and I say, if I can't stay sober, I'll go to AA. And I figure that's going to scare me into just staying sober on my own, because my vision of AA is just a bunch of old guys sitting around smoking and being miserable, right? Isn't that what AA is, right? So I was able to stay a little sober on that. And so I'm trying to do all this stuff. I've got a degree in psychology and biology. I actually did graduate with that degree. So I'm trying to do all that, you know, and there's some good stuff there. There really is. I'm seeing a therapist, and he's given me good stuff to do, but it's just not working on this disease. And I'm exercising, I'm bike riding, I'm doing that stuff, and it all helps a little, but it always comes back to, I've got this compulsion. I've got to quiet those voices in my head, that fear, that feeling of less than everybody else. And so what happens? I go back to LA, tell my wife I'm not going to drink this time, and she believes me, and I drink again. So she looks at me and she says, well, you said you were going to go to AA. And I try all the excuses. Okay, I just got to exercise more. I got to see a new therapist. I got to do something, right? And I even found Rational Recovery, which says you can drink a little. I said, can I go there? She goes, that doesn't sound like it's going to work for you. And she's right. It wouldn't have worked for me. So I call up the central service there in Tyler, Texas. And I get this wonderful guy who's just so happy. And he says, I'm so glad you called. It's 11:30. There's a meeting right down your street at a great clubhouse called the Alpha Group. Go down there. Tell them you're new. And they'll be glad to see you. So it takes all my courage in the world to get in that car and drive down to the Alpha Clubhouse. And I'm driving down there and I'm sitting in the parking lot and the conversation in my head. It's not a committee, it's a civil war up there, right? It's, you do not go in that room. There's got to be in a, come on, you're smart enough, you can figure this out. Come on, she'll understand. And so, but it was, here's what happened. I'm sitting there. And it's not just old guys going in there. There's a teenage girl who walks in, who's smiling. She's talking to somebody else. A guy pulls up on a Harley. He looks pretty cool. And he walks in there. I see all kinds of people. They're standing out front, and they're smiling, and they're laughing. And I'm looking at this thinking, And that little tiny spark of hope inside me gets a little more. So I walk inside, I open the door, I expect everyone to clap, hey, here he comes. But they're all sitting there, and I just sit down, and they start the meeting, and they say, is this anybody's first meeting? And I'm so scared, I don't raise my hand. I don't raise my hand, and they start to go around the room. And one guy says, I'm 7 days sober, and it's so hard. I want to drink every day, but you guys are helping me, and I 7 days. And I think, whoa, that guy went 7 days without alcohol. You know, that, I don't know, but that sounds good. The next lady, and so I'm 35 years old at this time. The next lady, she has 36 years of sobriety. And she says, she's talking about how wonderful life is and how she's sponsoring people. But then she relates a story about how she couldn't iron unless she was drunk on wine. So I'm seeing, okay, I can relate to the guy who's 7 days sober. I can also relate to this lady. She's got 36 years of sobriety. She's sponsoring people. But she couldn't do something simple like even iron unless she was drunk. I relate to that. That's great. So they go around. The next guy introduces himself. He says, my name's David, and I'm a sensitive alcoholic. And I thought, yeah, I'm a sensitive alcoholic too. So they go around the room, and it comes to me. And it's wonderful, the miracle that happened just in that hour when I was sitting there and listening to everyone. I realized there were people who drank like me. I didn't feel like I was in that black hole anymore. I knew there was hope. I knew there were people who drank like me, and now they actually have some peace and serenity. So when it got to me, I said, my name's Owen, and I'm an alcoholic. And people came up to me after the meeting. It was great. That guy who was a sensitive alcoholic, he came up to me, and he talked about, he was a pharmaceutical rep, and he was talking about all the different stuff he did and how, and I guess one of my big fears, I'm a musician. I love to play guitar. And a big part of my musical background is with drinking. I would always be drinking, going to concerts, playing guitar. So I told him, I said, but I'm going to have to give all that up, right? And he said, no. He said, if that's really part of something that you enjoy, when you're sober, you'll be able to do it better. He said, most people who drink, they're blocking out the stuff. They think it's better. But whether whether you're a writer, whether you're an artist, whether you're a musician, some of the best musicians are sober. He tells me, you know Eric Clapton? I said, yeah. The guitar god Eric Clapton says he's sober. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I said, that's my favorite band. In fact, they're coming to town on Good Friday here. I'm going to go see them. He said, they're all sober. I said, the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I grew up with them out in L.A. I saw them when they were all crazy drunk. And he said, they're all sober. That gave me a lot of hope, knowing that people can rock and roll and still be sober, you know, and you can do it even better. You can enjoy it more. So, you know, looking back, I see all these people God put in my life. And it was so wonderful to have that group there. They had five meetings a day. It was a clubhouse, and it was pretty small. It was smaller than the Howe Place. And I met this guy, Kelly. Kelly was wonderful. He was an artist. And that second meeting, we were talking in the parking lot, and we're talking. He's telling me how he's been sober for 2 years, and he just has a little girl that was just born. and how he's really struggling financially, but how life is so good, and how he's got this sponsor named Don. And he said, "Do you have a sponsor yet?" I said, "No, I don't have a sponsor." He goes, "I got to take you out to meet Don." So he takes me out to meet this guy, Don, Don Carroll. And he's passed away, but I love to say his name in these rooms because I know he's still with us. He's still with us today. And Don was 35 years sober. And I sat down there, and I'd only been sober a little while at that time. And I didn't know if I could stay sober. I had hope, but it was interesting. My disease, you know, my disease would tell me, they all got it, but you're not going to get it, dude. You're not going to get it. There was still that little fear inside me that there's something that I'm not going to get here. So I sat down with Don, and Don said, "You know, where are you at?" And I told him, you know, real quick, encapsulated version of my life story. And I said, "And I still don't know if I can get this. I don't know if I can be sober. I haven't worked in 2 years. I know I can never get a job again, but just because I'm so damaged." And he just kind of giggled at that. He said, "Don't worry, we'll get you a job. You can find a job." And I said, "I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can stay sober." He came over and he hugged me. And he looked at me and he smiled. And he said, "I'm going to walk you through these 12 steps like somebody walked me through the 12 steps so you can take this and do it to somebody else." And that gave me so much hope because it wasn't about me then. It wasn't, oh, poor me, or will I do this? He helped me see that we're all connected here. It's this big chain of alcoholics. It started with Bill W. and Dr. Bob. And when someone takes you through the 12 steps, then the beauty of it is you got to take somebody else through the 12 steps. And so I said, "But I'm so worried about this." He goes, "Well, how willing are you? How willing are you to stay sober and do these 12 steps?" And I thought about it. I said, "You know, Don, I'll do anything." He said, "If you'll do anything to stay sober and to work these 12 steps, then you're guaranteed to have a spiritual awakening and you can do it. It's all contingent on your willingness." And he liked this saying. He goes, "We're going to get down to the causes and conditions, especially through step 4 and 5. We're going to get down to the causes and conditions." I told him that little story about the math test and my dad. He said, "Sounds like your ego's really big right now." And I said, wait, I don't think I'm better than other people." And he said, "Your ego is the part that makes you feel better or worse than others." And I really like Chuck Chamberlain in New Pair of Glasses. He says that. The ego is the conscious separation. It's that separation from God. But in my life, the way it manifested is it was that part that made me feel worse than everybody else. The ego is the part that makes me feel better or worse. And just that little definition of the ego made me feel better. It's like, that's true. Every time I put myself down, say I'm not as good as the people in my family, I'm not as good as the people in AA, that's separating me from you. And he said, "When people share an AA, listen for those similarities." I said, "Yeah, I hear that. Just ignore the differences. Listen for those similarities. You can find it in everybody." And so pretty quickly, he started taking me through the steps, and it was beautiful. I remember about a month into this, my wife hugged me, and she looked at me and smiled. That smile, not that smile of, "I hope you're going to stay sober," but that smile. And she looked at me, and she said, "I have my Owen back. Don is an angel. I don't know what you're doing at those meetings, but keep doing it." This is beautiful. And I, like I said, I hadn't worked in 2 years, and I was still, you know, I had convinced myself I couldn't work. I didn't know how I was going to get by, but I couldn't work. Maybe I could just go to AA for the rest of my life. And Kelly comes up to me one day, and he's selling ladies' shoes at Dillard's. He's a salesman. He's making pretty good money. He goes, "Dude, come get a job with me. I think I can get you on selling ladies' shoes at Dillard's." I said, "Oh, no, I'm college educated. I can't work at Dillard's." And he said, "Well, what do you think your sponsor would say about that?" I said, "Oh, my sponsor would agree." He goes, "Okay, go talk to your sponsor." Now, Don is Kelly's sponsor, right? So he kind of knows what he's going to say. So I go out to Don. I said, "You know, Don, Kelly said he could probably get me a job at Dillard's selling ladies' shoes, but I don't need to do that, do I?" And he said, "Oh, yes, you do." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, first of all, you need a job." He read me that little part from the forward to the 12 and 12. And it says something like, AA is a set of spiritual principles when practiced as a way of life can enable the sufferer to not only expel the obsession of alcohol, but enable them to be happily and usefully whole. And he said, if you're going to be happily and usefully whole, you have to be self-supporting through your own contributions, just like the AA groups. You need a job. Second of all, I thought, oh no, here comes a second thing. He told me the first one, the second thing is, you need some humility if you think you're too good. If you think a college degree means you don't have to go sell ladies' shoes. He said, third of all, you could learn something in this job. This isn't going to be your job for the rest of your life. And fourth of all, you go in with the right attitude, you can enjoy this. I thought, that's great. He's right. If I go in there with the right attitude, I can enjoy this. So I go get a job selling shoes at Dillard's. And my wife laughed because it was November. It was about this time of year. And she goes, you hate shopping. You hate the mall. You get to sell lady shoes all the way through the Christmas season. And she just laughed. But you know what? I really enjoyed that job. I did. I could do it. I was only there for like 2.5 months, and a better job came along. And so, you know, it was great the way that worked out. And I got a job at a fajita company there. There in Texas, there's this fajita company, John Soul's Foods, there in Tyler, Texas. And they make great fajitas. In fact, they supply like all the chilies and the On the Border with all the fajitas. They're delicious fajitas. So I get a job there, and things are going pretty good. I'm working in the customer service department. I'm doing logistics. I'm helping them with some other stuff. And they pair me up with this girl, and we have to work really closely together, and our jobs kind of depend on each other. And she's kind of challenging to work with. And every week as I go out to my sponsor, he asks me about challenges, you know? And so I tell him, I say, you know, this girl, I said, I'm praying, I'm using prayer. And he said, how are you using prayer? And I said, every morning I pray, I hope that Tammy doesn't make me mad today. So he said, think about that prayer. Think about that prayer. You're asking God to change her. And, you know, he said, let's look at the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I can't change. He said, can we change anybody else? I said, no, the courage to change the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference. He said, what can you change? I said, I can change myself. So that prayer flipped. And the prayer was, God, help me see her as the beautiful child of God she is. And help me see how I can work with her. And that changed my whole dynamics there of work. And it changed the whole way I looked at the world. That I don't need the world to change for me to be happy. I don't need all the fill in the blanks. Through my whole life, it was always, if I just got this prestigious job, if I just had the right girlfriend, if I had enough money, I'd be happy, right? And I'm so glad that I learned in AA, I don't need the world to change. I can be happy today, as long as I'm working a strong spiritual program and trying to help other people. So I would go out and see Don every week. And I remember one week, he would talk about, as I go out there, I'd turn off the radio, it was about a half hour drive, and I'd go over my week, think about the challenges and the good stuff that happened. And looking back over the week, I remember I didn't want to drink that whole week. It was the first time in my life I'd gone a whole week and just, I didn't drink and I didn't want to drink. And that part he read from the 12 and 12, it's true. That compulsion to drink had been expelled. And I felt this gratitude. I felt, that's where gratitude just started to well up in me. And there was a woman in our group, Marlene, that woman who had been 36 years sober. And she kept pushing this gratitude list. She kept pushing, do a gratitude list. Do it for a couple weeks. Try to do new things every day. If you're sober, if you got clothes on your back, food in your belly, you know, you can start there and then be grateful for everything in your life. So I started doing that, and it really helped. I'd work this long shift, 7 a.m. to 5 p.m., and by the end, I'd be whipped. And so I'd forget to do it a lot of days, but I'd have it come up on my computer at about 4, 4:30. I'd do my gratitude list, and I'd instantly feel better. You know, it's this thing, and Dr. Paulo talks about it, and acceptance is the answer. What we focus on in life grows. We have this magnifying mind where if I focus on all my problems, they're just going to grow. If I focus on the good stuff in life, it's really going to grow. So I'm doing my gratitude list, and I get it to where it only takes a couple minutes. I take a little break out of my day. And one day, I'm sitting there at my little cubicle doing my gratitude list, and I hear from behind me, I hear, and I look around, and my boss is standing there looking over my shoulder, reading my gratitude list. And he said, that doesn't look work-related. And so, you know, I've always had a problem with dishonesty. And so I'm thinking, okay, how can I, you know, and I'm so glad that I used the program and I just was honest. And I looked at him and I said, you know, you're right. This is not directly work related, but it's my gratitude list. And it's really helping me. And this is where I start to embellish a little bit. I say, it's starting helping me be a better worker. And And he looks at me and he goes, "Wow, that's working. We just thought you were on drugs." But he looks at me and he says, "Whatever you're doing, keep doing it. Your positive attitude is contagious around here, and we really appreciate you." So I'm keep doing the gratitude list. It's really working. And I've been there about 5 years, and I start to feel like I should do something else. And the girl I'm working with, that girl, now she's telling me, you know, I'm training people. She says, "You should really be a teacher." And my brother's an educator. So I see this program. If you have a degree in science, you can go one summer and start to be a science teacher, since I have that biology degree. So I tell them I'm going to go back to school and become a teacher. And the head of the company, John Soles Sr., my last day there, he brings out this cake. And it's so cool. It says, "Owen, I wish I could be in your class." And he looks at me and he says, "If those kids really irritate you, or if this doesn't work, you can come back and you can work here again." And I thought, this is great. An actual company that asked me to come back. All the companies I've been fired from drinking. And now this company, actually, I could come back. So I start working, and this program, they throw you into the classroom. Literally, that's what it felt like. They throw you into the classroom with not much training. They give you a mentor, but it's basically baptism by fire. And I'm in an inner city school there, really poor school. In seventh grade, a lot of these kids are already in gangs, and I'm really struggling. I had these visions of going there and just changing the world. And pretty quickly, you know, there's fights in my classroom. I'm trying to find these kids' parents, and a lot of times they're in jail. They don't have it. And so I'm talking to my sponsor. I'm saying, you know, gosh, you know, I thought I'd be able to change the world doing this. And he says, "Just do your best. Leave the results to God." Words that I love. He kept hammering that in every day. Just do your very best. Leave the results to God. And so I do that. And, you know, I had 120 students. You know, I taught science every day, so a total of 120 students. And the miracles start happening. There was a seventh grade boy there, and he was starting to get into gangs. He was failing. We were trying to learn the scientific method. I remember handing him the paper on the scientific method. He balls it up and he throws it in the paper. "Give me an F, Mr. G." He'd call me Mr. G. And so I kept working, and my mentor told me something. She said, "It might seem like you're not reaching these kids, but all it takes is the appropriate adult at the appropriate time, and you can change a kid's life." So this kid, for whatever reason, Ricardo was his name, one day I pass out the paper, and I'm expecting him to ball it up and throw it in the trash and give him another F, and he looks and says, "Mr. G, come over here. I want to learn this today." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." So I'm helping him, and he starts to help his friends. He turns out by the end of the year to get straight A's. And so when I have an award to give at the end of the year, I give it to him. So I go to my mentor, I say, "That thing you said about the appropriate adult, this is great. This happens every year you teach, right?" She said, "No, I've been teaching 9 years. It hasn't happened to me yet." There must be a reason that you saw this happen. I had another little girl, and she was in seventh grade. And she said, "Mr. Griffith, I want to be a scientist. I want to go on and become a doctor." And I said, That's great. My sister's a doctor. There's so many people you can help. And she said, "My mom, I was taken away from my mom because she was a prostitute who was addicted to crack. So I'm never going to drink, I'm never going to do drugs, and I'm not going to date boys until I get in college." And so I also saw how addiction was just impacting these kids, and how me being addicted to alcohol, I could help some of these kids. And so the miracles were really happening there. And at this time also, my wife's grandmother got really sick here. She lived up in Waleska. Her name was Gertrude, and she was great. As I started to get sober and I started to open up to God, she'd say stuff like, she'd say, "Did you feel me praying for you last night?" And I said, "What? Feel you praying for me?" And she said, "Yeah, sometimes in life when you feel good, it means someone's praying for you. So if you feel good at night, it's because I'm praying for you." And I thought, that's so strange, but I like it. So I started turning around on her. I'd call her up. I'd say, "Did you feel good yesterday?" She'd go, "Yeah, were you praying for me?" So we got this connection, and she was really sick. So my wife went back. As I went back to become a teacher, my wife went back and became a nurse. So after 1 year of teaching, we moved here. We moved up to Waleska with my wife's parents who were here and her grandmother. And I got kind of nervous because I've been 5 years sober. And so I asked my sponsor, "What do I do? I've never moved before. And, you know, I want to stay sober." And he said, "Well, it's real easy. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Restart your program. Find a home group. Find a sponsor. If you ever feel squirrely, if you ever feel fear, if you ever feel those character defects coming back on you, just look for somebody to help. Look for somebody to help. And those words are true. Whether you're moving or not, that's always a good way to reboot your program. And I was going to retreats with some of the guys there in Texas. Every 6 months we were going to retreat. And before I left, I went to this retreat and it was really great. At these retreats, they'd have someone who was either a priest, a minister, or a rabbi who was an alcoholic lead these retreats. And so this was a Franciscan priest. And he did the whole thing on the Serenity Prayer, but it wasn't just the beginning of the Serenity Prayer. It was the full Serenity Prayer. I'd never seen that second part. And so I, being a teacher here, I made copies if anyone wants it at the end. There will be a test. But I just want to read it real quick. It goes, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Now here's the part I love. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardships is the pathway to peace. Taking as he did this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it. Trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will, that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. And I love that. So much of that spoke to me. I mean, that beginning part, living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time. You know, I find my conscious contact with God in the moment. I need to be present. Accepting hardships as a pathway to peace. I still want life to be easy. But sometimes, you know, we got to accept. Things are going to be hard. That's a pathway to peace. And trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will. Surrendering daily. So this is something I say every day. So, you know, I moved here and I was going to take a year off of teaching. You know, it was a great year, the miracles, but I thought I needed a year off. So I'm applying to some jobs. And one guy responds to my resume and says, you know, I could give you a job here, but I see you're a teacher. Can I forward your resume to a really good private school? I said, sure. So he forwards it to Blessed Trinity Catholic High School. Now, I used to joke, I was raised Catholic, and I used to joke that I was a recovering Catholic. And I had so much resentment for the Catholic Church because I had this vengeful God, you know, and I had all this fear that was part of that. But, you know, I went in and I interviewed with this guy and he said, you know, I don't have any jobs, but let me send your resume out. And so it's so funny, but a nun gets my resume and a nun calls me up and says, do you want to come in for an interview? So I call my mom up. I said, Mom, I have an interview with a nun. What do I do? And she said, just say a prayer. Be honest. Be yourself. So I go in. I'm expecting some old, you know, grizzled old nun. But this woman's young. She's young. She comes out. And she doesn't even sit behind her desk for the interview. She sits next to me. And her one question is, tell me a little bit about yourself. So I just tell her about my teaching. I tell her about, you know, my struggles and my challenges. And at the end, she looks at me and she goes, I think we have a place here for you. Would you like to teach fourth grade? I thought, yeah, I've been teaching middle school. And affectionately, we call the middle schoolers the hormonally challenged kids. So fourth grade sounded pretty good to me. And so 10 years later, I'm still teaching fourth grade at that school. Now, here's the really cool part. Damon became my sponsor when I moved here. I found the Breakfast Club. This was my home group. You know, I haven't been able to come here as much these last years, but I still come enough, and that you guys still mean a lot to me. My home group now is the Triangle Group up in Waleska. It meets on Sunday nights at 8 o'clock at Our Lady of La Salette. If you're ever up there, please come. We'd love to have you. It's a growing group up there. But Damon was talking about, if you live by these spiritual principles, you'll have a life beyond your wildest dreams. And sometimes I believed him, sometimes I didn't. But as I started to implement these principles, Damon was such an embodiment of that. And he took me through the steps again. He took me through the steps. And great things started happening. I started using gratitude, what I learned in these rooms, gratitude lists with my students. I started doing that. Other teachers saw this and started doing that. One of my fellow teachers said, you got to start a blog. You got to put this thing you're doing is so successful. My students are doing great things like taking the gratitude list to their parents. And I'm telling them, gratitude is much more than a pleasant emotion. It should be an action. If I'm grateful, you shouldn't hear me talking about it. You should see the way I'm living. You should see that I'm going to help other people. And I'd put that challenge out to all of you today. Try to show your gratitude to somebody. Try to tell them you're grateful. try to take some action. I think every day I try to tell my wife I'm grateful to her in a new way. Every day I try to tell my son. Every day I try to tell my coworkers, my students. You know, and there are opportunities to do that if I'm looking for that. You know, gratitude is an action. It really is. And so I start this blog. I start to get hits from all over the world. It's really nice. On Blogger, you can see people in France start hitting this site about gratitude. In Russia, where I need, they need gratitude in Russia, right? And so George Lucas started a website for teachers called Edutopia. And I put one of my blogs on there. And 10,000 teachers hit that blog the first day. In that first week, 25,000 other people, or mostly teachers, have seen it. And I get an email from a publisher, and she says, you have a really good message here. Would you like to write a book? And so this is where, you know, beyond my wildest dreams, I never thought I'd write a book. And since, you know, this has happened, people have told me they've tried to write books for decades, but I see how God is just working. And I said, well, what would I need to do? I haven't written a book. And she said, well, you just have to write 20 pages. You have to put your proposal together. So I do that, and she accepts it. And so that book got published in March this year, and it was a bestseller. And Damon helped me with that. And now my sponsor is Bruce. And I didn't know what to call the book, but I said, Bruce, you know, what would be a good name for it? We have to have gratitude. And he said, call it Gratitude, A Way of Teaching. And I think about that in these rooms. Gratitude, A Way of Teaching. We are teaching each other with gratitude. We are taking each other through 12 steps. We are teaching with gratitude. And other great stuff has happened. I was flown out to UC Berkeley because I'd been doing this gratitude for 10 years. And I told you about that positive psychology. The research started to catch up. So there's actually scientific research that shows people who keep gratitude lists are happier, they're less depressed, they sleep better. And students who keep gratitude lists, they do better academically, there's less discipline problems. So the John Templeton Foundation, I'd never even heard of them, but it's a big philanthropic, they gave $10 million to try to get educators to do this. So they flew me out to UC Berkeley to this conference, and I got to stand up in front of the top researchers from across the world and share my story. And so I'm gonna go out there again in February and talk to them. And then one of my colleagues, we're gonna go out to Anaheim in March and spread this message of gratitude that I learned in these rooms. Education is at a real crossroads right now, public school education especially, where teachers are just so overwhelmed with, you know, and it's an outside issue, but I'll just say I'm so grateful that a little bit of what I learned in here is going out now to teachers. So I send a thing about the book to John Soles, right? My old boss. And I said, hey, I just want to let you know what I'm doing these days. He required all the salesmen in the company to get gratitude away of teaching. And he said, if I have grateful salesmen, they're going to sell more. So the book has started to go out. My mom bought 20 copies and takes it to the grocery store and says, my son wrote this book. And, you know, for so many years, I thought that I never made my parents proud. But part of the 12 steps of making amends to them was seeing that they loved me. And my dad saying that thing was just his way of trying to motivate me. I was able to forgive them and get so close to them. And I was able to go out to their church this summer and give a talk. I was able to do a book signing at Barnes & Noble near my parents' house. My parents came. My old high school counselor, who was 91, he had to take two different buses to get to this book signing. He came, and also, I didn't tell you this, but one of my counselors fired me as a patient because I showed up at 9 a.m. so drunk, she fired me. She looked at me, she said, Owen, I can't help you. I love you, you're a great guy, but I can't help you because you're drunk. I sent her an email because her office was right down the street from this Barnes & Noble. And I said, I don't know if you remember me, but I'm going to be doing this book signing. Can you come? She sends me an email back. Oh, yeah, I remember you. And I can't wait to come to your book signing. So she comes to the book signing. She gives me a hug. She looks over at my parents who were talking to my high school counselor. And she says, your parents are glowing. Your parents are glowing. Can you see how proud they are of you? And I thought, I'm 51 years old. This might be my last chance to see this. But the healing that this program can bring, even if I didn't write a book, my life would be on my wildest dreams. Because I'm sober today, I feel loved. I can give that love away. And I know that no matter what's happening in my life, it's an inside job. If I am grateful, then all these promises are coming true. So I love you guys. I'm glad to be here. And thank you, Karen.